So again, welcome. My name is Jacques Verdun. I've spent 20 years working in state prisons. I'm the director of the Inside Out organization. And I brought a friend tonight. His name is Glenn Hill, one of my favorite students. Glenn did 40 years in a lot of it in San Quentin, and has it been 4 months, 3 months?
2.5 months.
2.5 months, okay. So I thought it'd be neat to bring him. He's a practitioner, and kind of improvise, play a little bit jazz tonight with him. Say a few things. Have Glenn say a few things and then do some Q&A. I just came back from a day at the Mule Creek State Prison, which is east of Sacramento. Because we're starting to spread the work now. We're in 4 different prisons running about 8 programs. This was a level 3 yard. And level 3 is the security. 4 is the highest, so level 3 is up there. And it was a really wonderful slice of the human condition, the group that we had. We had a transsexual, we had a brain surgeon, we had a veteran that was cutting himself out of trauma. We had a 22-year-old that could write poems like the English poets can. 2 Native Americans that were illiterate. And somehow we managed to find a way of becoming a tribe. Because that's what we do. I recognize some faces, so I'm aware I've shared a little bit, so I don't know exactly, you know, how much and to whom. But the program that we run is called Guiding Rage into Power, trying to not confuse the two. And the acronym is GRIP. And it's sort of the best practices of a number of programs that I've launched over the years. And it's based very much upon a Navajo American saying that describes an offender as he or she who acts as if they have no relatives. He or she who acts as if they have no relatives. So it speaks about bonding and how accountability comes out of experiencing meaningful relationship. And so, to embrace that statement, we form a tribe. We don't just have a class or a group, but we become a tribe. And the name of the tribe is a little ritual on how to find that. We go around the room and we ask everybody, how long have you served? You know, including juvenile, federal, county, whatever you had. Then we write that number on the board and we add it up. And so the first tribe was 936. 32 men that have served 936 years. And then I think yours was 928.
Right? Yeah, 928.
Right. And so then the next part of the tally is, how long were you in your moment of imminent danger? Imminent danger is a piece of the curriculum that speaks about the moment between anger and violence, or the moment between craving and using. And it's usually a moment that goes by rather quickly, so you have to ID it, you have to identify it. It's got 3 characteristics. One is everything speeds up. You don't have to be in prison, by the way, to encounter these impulses. Anybody in a long-term relationship can start nodding their head now. Everything intensifies is the second, and the third is there's usually a moment of regret afterwards if you didn't identify it, you didn't catch the moment. So we go around the room and we say, you know, how long were you in your moment of imminent danger when you committed your crime? And it's the moment, you know, where you crossed the boundary and committed your crime. For a lot of the men in San Quentin that I work with, that's a murder. And we go around the room and we add that up. And it's usually a short moment. You know, when you really say, when did I may have been thinking about stuff for days, but when did I cross that boundary? So we'll have 936 years in this ant and 42 minutes and 12 seconds in the other ant. And it gets a little quiet in the room. And that's just a beginning element of our welcoming ritual when we start the group. And there's a number of elements to the work. Some of it has to do with writing essays or letters of unfinished business. And I want to share one with you. This is from the 22-year-old. And the request is to write a letter of unfinished business with someone that you have unfinished business with. It's for most of us, it's more than one person. But the task is to pick one. And so Colton picked compassion as a person or as an entity. So he goes, my dearest compassion, as part of the GRIP curriculum, I just explained that. So, okay. My dearest compassion, whatever has happened to your luster, being once a tool of great understanding and flawless in your expression of agape love, now dead within me. Have you been hiding your face out of fear of being hurt or rejection? You've put your trust in so many. The great God has never forsaken you. Only have you ceased to see him when you turned away. And not you, but I. And this pains you, I know. I have allowed your death, I have killed you violently with hand and foot many a time to seek out my own selfish desires. Never coming to grips, kind of pun there, never coming to grips with this, I have suffered many cruel days and have allowed others to suffer, sometimes being the cause. For this, I am sorry, so sorry. But I am not done with you. Many have told me to keep you 6 feet down to survive this time alone in this place. But without you, I realize I'm but a shell of a man, driven by a violent wind. I'm ever put low for what I have done to you. Without you here by my side, I have gone astray to call anger, hate, jealousy, and mistrust my friends, evil friends you used to keep at bay. Listen to me now as I call you back to life with these words of my heart. Arise from our casket, be dead alive no longer. Awaken within this heart, that you may once again set the day afire with your love and wisdom. Please come back to me. I am empty without you. Sincerely, Colton. So it can be very surprising, you know, as to who we have down based on fear-based media, as to who our prisoners are. I've met very remarkable people there. One of them sitting right next to me, actually. I met Glenn a number of years ago, about 3-4 years ago.
Yeah, 2011.
And, you know, something happened between us. I don't know if it's a bromance of sort, but we connected. I saw him and he saw me, and so a relationship started. And Glenn participated in the program that we do. And I also got him in touch with the Innocence Project because he did 40 years for a crime he did not commit. And they couldn't do much for him because the case was so old and there was missing documents. So we had to let that go. Then he went to the Board of Parole hearings and written an essay about what he had learned in the GRIP program. And they interrupted him and said, "You didn't write that." So he had the written version in his pocket, pulled it out. Somebody had typed it up, and he had written it. They said, "It's so good, can we have a copy?" And they gave him a release date. So he's been out now for 2.5 years. Months. And he found a nice place, a really nice place. It's a halfway house in Hayward, where there's some fruit trees and some garden, and since a couple of weeks, a few little chickens as well, right?
Yeah.
And Glenn is a bit of an avatar, without maybe knowing what that word means. And so I want to give you the benefit of having ample time with him. And I'm going to give you this mic. And maybe one thing to start with, because that's pretty dramatic, doing 40 years for something you haven't done. Are you bitter about, you know, that fact, or how does that sit with you?
Get a portion.
Yeah, you got to hold it a little bit. Right.
No, I'm not bitter. Before I went to prison, I led a lifestyle that was a criminal lifestyle, and the criminal lifestyle is what led me going to prison for a crime I didn't commit. And I think that it was God that put me in a situation to send me to prison so that I could better myself and become a better person. Because going to prison was, when I was there, it was horrible. I didn't like it. But since being out, I understand the purpose of it. It was like a college, it was like a school for me to learn about myself, learn about other people, learn what other people's going through. You know, I was introduced to mindful meditation, I was introduced to GRIP, and through GRIP, I was able to set my inner self free to be a meditator, and I became a meditator. And I had so much anger inside me that I didn't even know I had the anger inside me. I didn't know I had the fear, the anger, the anxiety. I didn't even know what that stuff was until I started doing the GRIP program. Once I did it and I identified my childhood trauma, and I was able to rectify by addressing it through writing and understanding myself as a person, I became more sympathetic toward other people's needs, and I became more human within myself. And I started doing meditation, and the meditation opened my mind up to a whole brand new world of gratitude and appreciation. And the more gratitude and the more appreciation I feel, it's the better I treat other people. And I think that people is more important than myself. I learned that during 40 years I was in prison. And that I think that had I not went to prison, I probably would have still been running the streets of Oakland in the ghetto doing the same thing that, you know, the rest of the people are doing. But today I feel like that I'm a peacemaker, and I feel like I'm able to understand and help the people that's up under me, that's going through what I went through, that didn't know how to talk to people, didn't know how to express themselves, had so much anger, not toward people, but anger toward myself. Because I didn't feel I was fit, I didn't feel like I was smart enough, I didn't feel like I was worthy of nothing, you know? So I treated everybody and everything according to the way I was feeling about myself. And that was because I didn't know how to express myself. I didn't know how to ask for help. I didn't know how to reach out to people. I didn't know how to talk to people. So I did everything aggressively, and it ended up in prison for
were arrested?
The first crime I ever committed, I was 8 years old. I stole a racing car set. Huh. And I just stole it on impulse because I didn't need it. I just walked down the street and I stole it. I got arrested for it. Went down to juvenile hall. My parents had to come get me. Then I got arrested later on for a burglary. I think I was like maybe 10. Around about 12, I started doing time, going to senior camps at Bow Ranch, which is juvenile camps. Kids that was delinquent, you know, didn't want to follow the rules and regulations of life. So, but really what it was is I was confused and I was trying to make a name for myself, and I knew I couldn't make a name for myself in the real world, so I created a fantasy world. The world I created was the world that I seen in the movies, you know, the people I seen in the streets, the hustlers, the thieves, the criminals, the everybody I ran was unfit, you know. My whole environment was a make-believe. It wasn't real. It was just people that had low self-esteem like me. So it was easy for me to make a name for myself and become somebody. And it ended up with me buying a car. Not getting the car registered, but taking the ignition out the car so that the people I ran with had access at getting the car. Evidently, somebody that was using the car committed a murder, a robbery, and they got scared because they killed somebody. They got scared and put the gun in the car and never said nothing to nobody. And by it being my car, I was accused of it. So,
because the car was registered to you?
Yeah,
it
wasn't registered to me. But
can you speak up? I can't hear you.
Oh, okay,
sorry.
I'm sorry.
If you hold the microphone like this,
like this.
Yeah.
All right,
gotcha.
Yes.
I'm
learning.
We're all learning. It's
technology. All right, thank you. Yeah, but anyway, you know.
But it was your car.
Yeah, it was my car. I had bought the car. I never got it registered because I bought the car to commit criminal acts in, you know. And I allowed people to use it, and somebody robbed somebody. I guess the robbery went bad and they ended up getting a murder behind it. I'm driving the car, so when I get pulled over, they find the gun in the car and they ask me, you know, about it and all that. And I didn't have the answers for them, even though they know I didn't commit the crime. They said that I knew who did commit the crime, and I withholding evidence. So, you know, but I think that it was God's intention, and I think God had a plan for me all the time. And I think that when the right time came, the right people came into my life to change my life, to make me into a better person. That's why I'm sitting here with y'all today, because I'm just like y'all, meditators, people that believe in peace, people that believe in, you know, unity and togetherness. And when we were doing that walking meditation, that was the first time we did that, and it felt so good. I felt so much energy and so much appreciation, especially when this lady over here with the blue vessel. By the time she was moving the ball around, I said, I can't wait to try that. I just can't wait. I see myself walking from the bar station right now. I didn't want to do the right thing. I didn't want to think I was coffee now. but I really enjoy it, and I appreciate y'all having me. Thank you.
So let me ask you a few quick questions and talk a little bit. So that's, you know, quite a movement out of jumping out of your time capsule. 40 years in prison. There's been a few changes in our lives here. Technology and all of that. How do you feel your meditation helps you, if it does? How do you feel that's a resource for you?
Well, I think that I'm more like live my life in the moment rather than, you know, 10 minutes from now, 5 minutes from now, 3 minutes from now. I just kind of like stay in the moment. And I noticed that a lot of people, they got all these phones and all that stuff. I got one too, because they all heard it all ring. And I apologize for that. It's just my family, you know, they don't hear from me for a long time. They get worried and nervous because they don't know where I'm at. They don't know if I'm lost or what. So I mean, I apologize for the ringing, but usually I don't want to never even carry it with me because it's a distraction and it keeps me from appreciating the beauty of the world, you know. Sounds and things that's going on in the world. So when I talk on the phone, I like to talk on the phone like they used to do in the old days, you know, where you got to call you at home, you know, out on the streets, you know, when you're know, somewhere else. So I find it like, kind of like difficult to carry a phone. I'm not really a phone person, you know. I like when I'm in the house, I'm outside, I like just to enjoy the trees, the flowers. I like to enjoy the trees, the flowers, the wind, feel it on my face, feel it in my hair, just hear the sounds of the car, you know. These are things that I took for granted. You know, I never noticed it, even though it was existing when I was out. I never noticed it until I got out this time. Mm-hmm. And when I had everything stripped from me, and now I got it back, I know how to appreciate it. Mm-hmm. And that's where the gratitude comes in at, in the meditation.
Thank you. Anybody else have a question you had to hand up?
I got one more time to say.
Okay.
This is important. I'm here today to answer any questions that might come across your mind. Don't be embarrassed. Don't think that you came to ask me. You know, you can be straight up with me. I'm a meditator. My mind is clear. My focus is clear. And I'm here for you just like I believe you're here for me. So feel free to ask anything you want to and be as honest as I can.
That's you.
So I actually have two questions. I think what's most important for me is when you were going through your transformation through the GRIT program, when you were having this education, this transformation, how did the people around you who weren't doing it, how mm-hmm. did you feel safe?
Let me repeat the question so everybody can hear.
I got it.
So that everybody can hear.
All right. That's a good question, too. That's an excellent question because the people, when they see me going to all these groups and stuff, they used to say, man, what's wrong with Glenn? Glenn tripping. He's going to all these people. People don't care about you like that. People ain't going to let you out and stuff. But I didn't let it distract me because I had a purpose and I had a goal. But now, everybody's trying to go to all right. Everybody's trying to go to GRIT. They said, man, can do it. We can do it, you know? Yeah, so, yeah, you know, like, people, they didn't understand it at first, you know, they couldn't see it because they just the old me, you know, running the yard, hanging out, playing down the road. So, well, I changed all that, started going to school, started going to classes, and, you know, meditation and GRIT and, you know, people start, you know, like, man, what's wrong with him? Why are you changing like this? What's getting into him? You know, but I didn't let it distract me because it felt so good to me that I kept doing it. And I kept doing it, kept doing it. And the more I learned about myself, the more I wanted to be a part of that life, you know. And so now everybody, so when I got pharmaceutical for parole, everybody, man, how can I get in GRIT, man? How can I get in this program? I can't do this, you know.
We had, of the first 182 students, all of them are life-sentenced prisoners, but life-sentenced with parole, meaning, you know, if you do 7 to life, you do 7 years flat, and then after 7 years, you can go to the parole board once in a while to plead your case and for them to evaluate you. So of the first 182 graduates, 51 were released, which is a high number, if you don't know how to think about that. And none of them have come back in 4 years.
That's
so it's pretty magical.
Yeah, I've lived in Oakland many years, and I tutored in a program in West Oakland. And I see over and over again these sweet elementary kids start junior high, and you know, the life of the streets, the peer pressure, just changed so quickly. I wondered if you had any insight or any ideas for how to help these kids through that transition of life so they have the kind of guidance?
Yes, ma'am. I think I might have an answer for you. I'm not going to say it's going to work, but you can try it because it works in the GRIP program, so it might work in your classroom. Like every morning when your students come in, have them write down what they're feeling and what they're seeing on their way to school. On the way to school as an exercise, just something to write down what you're really feeling right now, and then have them turn it into you, and then you'll understand the person a little bit better from making any sense, you know. You know, this is just my opinion. I'm not, because this is what helped me. So I'm just saying, me writing down what I was feeling and what I was thinking helped me a lot. You know, sometimes, you know, it's hard to get your words across because people don't have time to sit and listen to you because everybody got to be on the phone, so nobody really got time to really hear what the kids got to say. So you come in, they come to classroom, they write it down, they turn it into you, and you give them a grade on it, then they're going to say, well, now I got somebody to listen to. So that's just a suggestion. I'm not saying it's going to work or not, but it helped me.
Do you think of meditation?
Yeah, meditation would be beautiful.
They're doing it in some of the schools, but it's not universal.
But probably you set your little, like, your little own little, like, maybe the first hour or so, just when you just set a time period just for you and your kids, you know, the ones that's in your classroom, and, you know, y'all sit and meditate for 10, 15 minutes, and then, you know, they write down what they're feeling and stuff, and then just take a few minutes just to listen to them, you know.
You know, talking about playing jazz here, I have something with me that you wrote while you were still in about meditation. Can I read it from that?
Yeah.
I got my own mic.
Oh.
Yeah.
When I'm sad, I meditate. When I'm confused, I meditate. When I'm unhappy, I meditate. When I'm hurt, I meditate. When I'm happy, I meditate. When I'm angry, I meditate. When I eat, I meditate. When I walk, I meditate. I used to think that meditation was something I did. I kept trying to get it right. But then when I became conscious of meditation and became still from within, I began to realize that meditation was not something I had to learn how to do because I am the core of meditation. I just had to learn how to be me for my core self. When I'm conscious and aware of myself, which means being mindful of what I am doing, I'm meditating. I'm there and I'm present in that moment, no matter if it's walking, talking, smelling, listening, eating, hearing, or just feeling something. I become that experience and it's mirrored in my actions and deeds. Meditation for me is being present in the moment and not getting caught up in the stories of the moment, not allowing the adjectives to dictate my present moment. Stopping to hear the sound of a bird or just seeing it fly without any judgment, I become that bird. Feeling a breeze from the wind, I become that breeze. I'm all things when I'm in my meditation, my core self. For me, life is beautiful when I just accept it as life. I live it and I appreciate it. The only time I'm not meditating is when I'm sleeping. Then I rest my own energy. Being focused and present at all times is my meditation. It's kind of fun to hear that spit back to you.
Yeah, with all of my.
Question?
I'm curious about the content of all of the hours that you spent in your GRIP program and what affected you the most deeply. And I'm also curious if the peace education program and, you know, what touched you or what you come out like of this cocoon, like a butterfly after all those years of being.
This is my favorite part, is I've met him. I kept telling him when I was doing the GRIP program, I said, man, I said, ain't nothing wrong with me, because I really didn't think there was nothing wrong with me, right? And so I kept saying, ain't nothing wrong with me, ain't nothing wrong with me. I said, oh, I can't write down none of this stuff because none of this stuff don't fit me, right? He said, just think about something. He said, just think about, you know, the first time that you was really, you know, hurt or sad or whatever, something that traumatized you, right? So I kept thinking, I kept thinking. Then I went all the way back to grade school, going into kindergarten, being afraid of the kids in there, moving in a new neighborhood, going to a different school, and all the little kids in there, and everybody seemed to know everybody and stuff. So I was real little and skinny. So I was like, I had a lot of fear. But I tried to hide the fear, to mask the fear, and it became violent. You know, I became violent. Because the master fear that I was feeling towards those kids, I wouldn't talk to them, I wouldn't interact with them and stuff. And that kind of opened my eyes up to where my trauma first started and what led me to be, you know, the kind of person I turned out to be, you know, that led me to prison. It was low self-esteem, low self-worth, you know, feeling afraid, you know, and not knowing how to express my fear, you know. And I learned that in GRIP, and when I learned it, it's like, wow. We had an acronym that we called, for fear, it was called false evidence appearing real. Some of the things that, you know, we tell ourselves in our mind, everybody else is seeing you as you are, as a good person, but in your mind, in my mind, I was telling myself that, oh, no, they talking about me, they mad at me, you know, they putting me through this right here. But I'm telling myself this, but this really ain't what's happening, you know. But I'm convincing myself of it, so I'm living like this because this is what I'm feeling inside, and I'm going to have to get it out to other people, you know, to express it. And that was my turning point.
I think we had one prisoner that had his own acronym for fear. Mm-hmm. And Robin said, F everything and run.
I was wondering, when you first were incarcerated at 12,
mm-hmm.
was there any attempt at all to work with you at that age? And for Jacques, if there's any thing now to, you know, to waste those 40 years to perhaps not have that happen to other people.
When I first started going to jail, the first time I went, I was 8, I was afraid, you know, because I've been there, you know, locked up in there, so I was a little afraid, right? But by the time I was like 9 or 10, I had been going so much, I knew everybody in the jail. I was in the counselor, and nobody was there trying to help us to understand. There was no doctor, there was nobody there. Counselor sitting back with their desk and things, letting us fight, you know, lift weights and boxing ring, you know, the winner get a candy bar, the loser get, you know, so ain't nobody was trying to help us. Then we all became friends. So coming to going to jail, it wasn't no fear of going to jail. So when you had fear of going to jail, you did what you wanted to do because it wasn't no fear there. It wasn't no punishment because you knew everybody. And everybody was 8 years old, everybody 9 years old, everybody 10 years old, everybody's your age range, you know?
It's like a tribe by themselves.
It's like a tribe. It's kids raising kids, you know. It, you know, they lock us up, you know, they lock us up and they gonna kick back and do what they gonna do, let us do what we gonna do. We steal these cigarettes, we smoke, so it wasn't nothing there to make you wanna just say, okay, well, let me see what's going on with this guy, you know what I'm saying? And then for me, my parents, they love me so much. And they tried to sacrifice so much to help me that really they hurted me, but the love that they gave me, because that love gave me permission to do what I wanted to do because I knew they were going to always be there for me no matter what I did. So I didn't see, it wasn't no consequences behind what I was doing. So I got comfortable in it, you know what I'm saying? So I walked around all the time with mean mug, my face all tight, my fist stuff. But I'm walking around like that big, but I'm thinking it's a cool walk. But I'm not knowing that it's the fear that I'm really holding inside. You know, once I released all that, man, I just love life now. You know,
we often have prisoners say, "Dang, I wish I'd known this when I was 15."
Yeah.
Right. And then just heard it a little too often to not do something with it. So we did. We worked in a youth center in Richmond. Very gritty place, you know, like every other month or so you'd have a memorial in the lobby because there was another drive-by victim. And we'd employ some of the released offenders, you know, like Glenn, to work with these kids. And that was very powerful to see because they're called OGs, you know, which is slang for original gangster. And there's a lot of respect for the OGs from the youth because you can hear there's like a little culture, you know, that happens. People want to belong to something. And we also did here in Nevada High School for 2 years. We brought in the superintendent to the prison so she knew what, you know, because it's not so easy to bring ex-offenders into school.
Yeah.
But she got it and they supported it and it was really powerful. You know, we ran out of money. But for 2 years this was really creating some results. Because, you know, there's a lot of father wound stuff with these youngsters. And so to bring some older males back is pretty potent, actually.
And I think women can help men, too, because most men, they do things to impress women. they want to impress their girlfriend, you know, look what I can do. So they got to say, okay, so it's y'all responsibility. Say, no, we knew you ain't got to do this to impress me, you know. I got you.
Yeah, there's a lot of image-based culture.
Yeah.
You know? Like the gangs, right? It's your swagger, it's your clothes, your colors, your tattoos. It's an identity of self that's image-based, which, you know, we all go through as teenagers. And then, so when we explain that there's another way, there's an authentic self and a felt sense of self that you can get in touch with, and then it's yours power, you're actually not running somebody else's show. A lot of these kids quite relieved to hear, like, whoa, there's another way to do this, you know? I just don't have that information necessarily. But that whole inner validated to outer validated shift is a very important piece there. You had your hand up a while back.
Yeah. You know, I have a lot of anger, really, and it's not, it doesn't feel like it's a cool thing to have in an environment like
mm-hmm.
this.
Right.
And it really gets in the way, because it gets turned in, you know, internal, and that's called depression, actually. So I hear you talking about identifying places in your life where there were earlier traumas. I hear about the process of the GRIP program that's able to touch in on different levels of anger triggers. And then I hear you talk about meditation as an ongoing process to deal with anger that's still there. Is the anger still there? Is it? Has there been a place that's really been particularly helpful to release that?
For me, I don't get angry no more because I got a better understanding of things now that I'm clear, you know. My anger was inside me. And once I discovered that it was anger, I took control over it. And I started telling myself, you know, that this ain't real. This is imaginary. I'm making this up, you know what I'm saying? And I started to do that. To understand what I was really feeling, you know, to understand, to be able to feel what I'm feeling, not try to fight the feeling, not try to change the feeling, but just accept the feeling and embrace it, and allow that feeling to become who I am, you know, and then now I'm living better than I ever did in my entire life right now today, you know. I mean, I'm seeing clearer, my mind is clear, my thoughts is clear. So if I'm walking in the store and somebody bumps into me, I don't get angry. I just step to the side. If I'm doing something, somebody get loud or say something, I might at the moment say, "Damn," I would say, "Stop this noise," you know. But then I catch myself because I remind myself that that's not me. That's them, you know.
There's another part too. There's an emotional intelligence component to the program. And one of the, and then we use these little flashcards for guys to really internalize the material. So one of the cards says that anger is a secondary emotion, meaning there's other feelings under it. And part of learning to self-regulate emotionally is to learn how to access these feelings inside the anger. And there's primarily three that we've seen. One is fear, the other one's hurt. And also for males, you know, that's like, doesn't fit the image-based culture. It's weak to, in prison, to be fearful or sad. And shame, you know, big one, shame. And so, there's a process of guiding people to recognize that once I'm aware, when I can flag the flash, meaning, you know, when I'm about to flash, in an angry mode, there's certain sensations that go along with that, and getting in touch with these sensations becomes the avenue to starting to feel the feeling inside the feeling. So, you know, and then it's not so much, oh, I'm sad or I'm angry, but this is fear or this is sadness, you know, and then, you know, getting honest with that. So that seems to be very potent, actually.
It's kind of like hard to do by yourself, though.
Yeah, it's good to have a tribe of people to do that with.
Or if you ain't got a tribe of people, like this group of people here, you know, you can embrace each other, you know what I'm saying? Just be honest and open with each other and things. And I'm telling you, man, when you get open and honest with people, things change, man, the world change, the world open up so much can come up out of you. But for me, it took a lot, you know, I mean, it took a lot. When I was in prison, I ain't had no gray, I was handsome, you know, man, I had a lot of balls, gray, but I'm happy, though.
You're still kind of handsome.
Thank you.
I was just curious because you mentioned family. You mentioned your family. And so how has this transition for you been with people that you are in relationship with? And you mentioned family, that you're in contact with them. How has your transition changed the relationship, or has it created a relationship? Or
Well, I've been really fortunate that my family stuck by me. And they embrace me, but it can be stressful too, because they started pulling me, you know, let's do this, let's go here, you know what I'm saying? There's never no time for myself, you know, so it can be like stressful there. But as far as the love goes, a lot, it's like I said earlier, sometimes it can be too much love, you know, and it's smothering, you know? So you gotta have some breathing room, and that's where mindful meditation come in, you know?
Gotta have some time with your chickens.
Yeah, gotta have time with chickens. I ain't never in my life, I look at chickens now more than I ever. I thought chickens just lay eggs, eat the eggs, they just, you know. But I see them now, they run up trees and flop around the yard. Now they just tickle me, you know. I love watching them, you know. I'm doing things now that I never in my entire life thought I would ever do. You know, I'm living, I'm really living now. Living, I'm not just existing, I'm not just here, I'm really, really living. I don't know how much time I got left on earth, but the little time I got, I'm enjoying it, and I'm living, and I'm grateful. I'm grateful to be sitting here, I'm just grateful, you know. Ma'am?
The gentleman there, and then the woman behind. Yes.
I just wondered, for you, Doc, if you could just say a word about the technique or the method of meditation.
Sure.
Meditation.
Yeah, yeah.
What precisely, you know, you've got the group of
yeah.
men, and how do you start that?
Yeah. The kind of meditation we've developed there over time is very much embodied awareness, is very much body based. So it's based on for example, inspiration, literally says inspiriting, right? And spirit is breath. So when you breathe in, there's a movement of the spirit entering. And when you breathe out, you expire, there's a movement of the breath passing through. And the meditation is much like sitting in the portal of those, in between these two movements, and noticing the movement of the spirit or the breath. When I say spirit, it's nothing esoteric. It's like, becomes clear when you have your head in a bucket of water, right? It's breath. Or it becomes clear when you see a dead body. It's not breathing. And it's, when you first time see a dead body, it's like, wow. You know, that's a confrontation. So breath, spirit. So sitting in the portal and letting that movement of the spirit orient you and wisen you. Believing there's an inherent capacity for wisdom in the body. It's a self-regulating organism. It's a unique expression of nature. And so paying attention to its functioning, even though, you know, we have the ability to abstract and get way out there, there's also a way to get way in there by simply really turning to our functioning, you know, like the movement of my hand as I speak to you, the sound of my voice, the nodding of your head, you know, the quality of the light as it does start to come in, those kind of things. So in that sense, everybody's welcome to. It isn't just the Buddhists or, you know, there's a tradition of contemplation in every religion, so everybody can come. Yes?
Glenn, I have a question. You mentioned self-esteem and self-worth.
Mm-hmm.
How did you work on reestablishing that for yourself, or building that up, or where are you with that?
I was doing the GRIP program, and I found out where my trauma came from and what caused me to have this low self-esteem and what have made me feel this low, you know, feel so bad about myself, not like myself. I started understanding more, and I started writing it out, and I started understanding it, so I was able to release myself from it. You know, once I understood it and I seen the cause of it, I knew how to identify it, and I knew that that's not what I wanted for myself, you know? What I wanted for myself was what everybody wants, just be a part of life, you know? Just be me, you know? So I learned how to be me. You know, the self-esteem and everything else, I admit it came because I didn't impress nobody. I didn't get caught up in materialistic things. I didn't get caught up in things that wasn't important, small things, you know? And I started letting all that stuff go, and I became centered. And once I became centered, I started developing as a whole person. And so today I'm really at peace with myself. I like who I am. I like, you know, the earth on my own, you know. I like everything now, you know.
Like what? Give me a slice.
I mean, I like the air, looking out the window, being able to use my hands. Being able to walk with my feet, being able to put my clothes on, being able to take a bath, being able to eat whatever I want to eat, you know? I mean, you know, it's just, life is just beautiful, you know? Yeah, life is just beautiful when I learned how to live it, you know? And stop trying to dictate it and trying to make it work, you know? I just let it be what it be, and I be what I be, you know? And it all worked out.
You can bow to him, it's okay. We're getting towards time, and there's two things that I wanted to do. The title of the curriculum is Leaving Prison Before You Get Out. Right.
Yeah, yes, and he had it hanging up for a long time, too.
He did?
Yep.
Okay. Shall we give him a try?
Yep,
okay.
Definitely.
What's the biggest challenge now?
The biggest challenge?
Mindfulness help with that?
find a little time to myself, a little peace to myself, you know. I think that's about the biggest challenge that, I've had since I've been out of prison, you know, just trying to find some time, you know.
Because during the day you're picking up trash for Caltrans.
Right? Yeah, I'm picking up trash for Caltrans. I ain't doing that. I'm doing things for everybody else want me to do. You know, go here, go there, do this, do that. You know, and then I'm so sensitive toward people that it's hard for me to say no. You know, so I still got to battle with that. So that's about the biggest challenge I have. Thank you.
So these are some gatherings. About what we're learning about what it takes to leave prison before we get out. So, one says, we're learning that being human is having entered the contract to learn how to listen. That learning to listen is the first duty of love, as Paul Tillich said. And that deep listening is the truest expression of worship. I mean, when you hear Glenn talk, you can hear he's listening, right? He's paying attention. We are learning that the cure for the pain is in the pain, as Rumi says, and that in healing every wound is also a movement that cuts me open. And that if I don't show up for the pain of the cut, neither will I receive the blessing that comes through that opening. We are learning that love is not so much a feeling, but a way of being present. We're learning that, in the words of David Rich, that true forgiveness is not an action after the fact, but an attitude with which you enter each moment. We learn that being free is not just a geographical fact. It's not just the other side of the gate. The heart of being free is not knowing where I am, but discovering who I am. We're learning to say thank you a lot as a true guide to find our place in the scheme of things. We're learning to accept each person and every situation as our teacher. And finally, we're learning to appreciate how true freedom lives in understanding that this moment is all there is, just as it is. So I wanted to share this from, and we'll end with that, from Edgar Moore, Mo, as a thank you letter. It was his last day of work, so dutiful as he is, he said, I can't come, but I'll write you a little note and a letter. And because Wednesday, a week ago, Mo got his A1 license. And for those of you who don't know, just like Glenn, I brought Mo, and everybody sort of fell in love with Mo. And reach out to, you know, realize his dream, which was to become a truck driver with an A1 license, and raise the funds for him to do that. And he talks about it all the time. He can't believe this happened to him. I'm so grateful for the help and support each one of you blessed me with. At first I thought it would be easy for me because of my old knowledge about driving. But things has changed. New laws and rules you must know and demonstrate when being tested. From May until July the 13th, I stayed at it 7 days a week, going to school on my days off from work. I could not let any of you down after all that each of you had done for me. Now that all the stress and weight... Yeah, he got skinny. He got so intense about his license. Now that all of the stress and weight loss, we can all breathe that I passed the test and I have my Class A1 license.
Yeah. Wow.
I was offered a job by the owner of the school and I accepted it. Because, they fell in love with him too.
Yeah.
I can't thank each one of you enough for what you did for me. Thank you again for helping me. And now I can be and feel part of society again, Edgar Moore Jr.
Oh my gosh.
So this is something you did. You got off your safu and you reached out. And it's amazing. So the card says, The kindness shown by each of you and the caring thoughts given were very touching and truly appreciated. Thank you from Edgar Moore. I have some photos of him with the truck that I'll send to your son.
Yeah, he'd speak to y'all all the time. I live with him, so he constantly remind me, y'all. Yeah. Grateful to you.
Do you have anything to say in closing that sort of closes out?
Only thing I can say is thank you for having me here. I appreciate it, and I feel the energy, and I thank you for allowing me to be here. I don't know what to say, but that's how I feel, so be here.
Thank you for coming.